test comes when his plan differs from yours. I prayed God would change my circumstances. Because I did not see an answer to my prayers, I stopped praying. Now I can humbly see that even a spirit-filled believer can become the person you described, one who questions God's love and turns away in disobedience. I was that person. And that decision to turn away from God led to the most painful experiences in my life for many years. I see now that the Lord was working things together for good even when I didn't feel it. Trusting in God's goodness, she asked him back into her life, though her questions about evil remained unanswered. In giving thanks, evil must not be minimized. But in refusing to offer a sacrifice of praise, the only recourse is to push God out of one's life for allowing the evil. This woman did what most do, who refuse to trust God and give thanks in spite of the evil. To ensure justice, she judged God as unloving, which in the end achieved nothing for her. Can you give thanks and still ask why? Does offering a sacrifice of praise answer the question why God did this happen? Not likely. But is it wrong to ask why? Absolutely not. As we pointed out, Jesus asked why while he hung on the cross. In his agony, he cried out, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Matthew chapter 27, verse 46. Though there are things we will never understand until God answers them in heaven, he promises to meet us in our pain as we offer our praise. Meditate on 1 Corinthians 13, verse 12. For many, the most difficult part of offering a sacrifice of praise is the burden of doing it day after day, month after month, year after year, without anything to mitigate the pain. While God often provides grace and comfort in the midst of crisis, some hurts never change, or at least seem to take forever to change. How, for instance, do you keep giving thanks for the weighty complexities of being disabled, or being the caretaker of one who is? How do you remain thankful for years of difficulty due to an accident, loss of employment, or the betrayal of a spouse or friend? How do you stay thankful for a difficult marriage or the ongoing hurts of a prodigal child? How do you rejoice over years of infertility or the long wait of some singles to find good spouses? It is not easy. Hannah, who eventually bore the great prophet Samuel, spent years of weeping before the Lord as she prayed for a son. Because she kept her face toward God in her time of suffering, she was able to offer God her song of praise when he fulfilled her heart's desire in 1 Samuel, 2nd chapter, verses 1 through 10. Some, like Hannah, begin in faith and thankfulness and yet grow weary over time. Does God leave them? No. Even Elijah, after praising God for his victory over the prophets of Baal, collapsed in the wilderness and cried out for death. Before he was again able to seek God, God gave him a chance to rest and eat angel food. Make no mistake, offering up a sacrifice of praise is a choice, and it may feel like work. But the good news is that God meets us in our sorrow, just as he met Hannah in her tears and Elijah in the wilderness. Sarah, my wife, says, I encourage everyone going through a time of suffering or confusion to offer God a sacrifice of thanksgiving. She loves to offer this sacrifice even if she sees nothing happening. After her cancer and double mastectomy, she waited for years not knowing if the cancer would return with a vengeance. Her sacrifice, a form of praise and worship, releases her faith. It provides her with confidence that God is working even if she cannot see it. Give thanks when God allows suffering and evil? Some do not think it wise or logical to offer praise to God for trying events. One pastor shared with me about the death of his 4-year-old daughter. Bewildered by her death, he and his wife asked the fundamental question, is God good? They concluded yes, and offered a sacrifice of thanksgiving, even though God never revealed to them why he allowed their precious daughter to die. Later, they shared their conclusion about God's goodness with the congregation. Several couples left the church. These couples had fervently prayed for the healing of the 4-year-old. But with her death, their faith floundered. They concluded that because God did not respond to their worthy prayer, then he lacked love or power. Because they believed God had power to heal her, they concluded God must be unloving if he did not heal her. When this pastor declared his firm faith in God's goodness, they felt confused and betrayed. Though they had been taught the biblical idea of the mystery of suffering, when unexplained suffering knocked at their door, they chose to walk away from faith rather than embrace God's unseen goodness in and through it. Believers who resent and reject God like this will not experience His unique leading. One cannot shake a fist at God in bitterness and refuse to trust and thank Him, as if spiritual pouting could force God's hand to provide an explanation to why. Indeed, the issue that causes more people to turn from God than anything else is the apparent contradiction that a loving God could allow so much suffering, especially when that suffering stems from evil intent. One woman in my church shared with me her story of ritualistic abuse. As a child, her parents engaged in satanic worship. The things to which they subjected her cannot be printed here. Years later, as a young adult, not knowing how to make sense of her childhood, she came to see me. She said, "When I first saw you, I was saying to God, why? Why, when you could see what was happening, would you not want to protect a little child?" Overwhelmed by her story, I admitted that I had no answer. But in obedience to Scripture, I tenderly asked her, "Have you thanked God for what happened? I say that because I have found that thanksgiving serves as a means of grace in dealing with evil, as odd as that may seem." Not surprisingly, she sat there in utter disbelief and anger. However, she later told me, "I couldn't believe you would tell me to give thanks for my horrible situation. Even so, your words haunted me because I desired to obey God. I moved forward in faith because you told me I could start by asking God to help me to want to be thankful. I started by telling God that if this was what He wanted me to do, then I needed Him to help me to want to be thankful. I asked Him to help me know how to tell Him I was thankful. I refused to say, 'Hooray, God, thanks for all the bad things that happened to me. That was some good time.' Over time, God helped me understand that I could be thankful because of how He brought me through and for the person He was going to help me become. After that, I gave thanks. Today, I stand back totally amazed at how God protected me from physical, emotional, and spiritual death. I also see how my past could have shaped me one way, but giving thanks shaped me another way." Thank God in the face of evil? This woman's victory over the evils that oppressed her youth was released by giving thanks. But let's not minimize evil. Neither let us deny the goodness of God in the face of evil. Corrie ten Boom, who suffered at the hands of the Nazis, shared, "Often I've heard people say how good God is. We prayed that it would not rain for our church picnic, and look at the lovely weather." Yes, God is good when He sends good weather, but God was also good when He allowed my sister Betsy to starve to death before my eyes in a German concentration camp. I remember one occasion when I was very discouraged there. Everything around us was dark, and there was darkness in my heart. I remember telling Betsy that I thought God had forgotten us. "No, Corrie," said Betsy, "He has not forgotten us. Remember His word, for as the heavens are as high above the earth, so great is His steadfast love toward those who fear Him." Betsy's death might well have left Corrie embittered toward God, but instead Corrie concludes, "There is an ocean of God's love available. There is plenty for everyone. May God grant you never to doubt that victorious love, whatever the circumstances." Over the years as a pastor in a college town, people asked how an all-loving and all-powerful God could allow evil to triumph. But that isn't just a question for intellectuals. Everyone asks this question. For me, I remember coming to a point when I read the Gospels, the narrative of the life of Christ, that I would trust Christ based on what I knew about Him in the face of my unanswered questions. I chose that posture as opposed to distrusting Christ based on what I knew about Him in the face of my unanswered questions. See the difference? No matter what, there will be unanswered questions about evil. Yet Jesus Himself, who endured evil beyond anything we can imagine, trusted in Abba Father's compassion and authority. Jesus asked why, but continued to trust in God the Father in the face of His unanswered question. I absorbed the truth that Jesus intends for me to imitate Him. The reality of evil brings each of us to this crossroads. Will we choose to give thanks to God in the face of our unanswered question about suffering and evil? Because we trust what we know about Him. A thankful heart forgives. Forgiving, as hard as it is not an option for the believer. Jesus prayed, "Forgive us our debts as we also have forgiven our debtors," Matthew 6, verse 12. John makes it clear that forgiveness is evidence of God's work in us. In 1 John chapter 4, verses 19 through 21, he says, "We love because he first loved us. If someone says, 'I love God,' and hates his brother, he is a liar. For the one who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. And this commandment we have from him, that the one who loves God should love his brother also." You see, one of the surest ways to miss experiencing God's will and blessing for your life is to refuse to forgive. Yes, there are hurts that rack the soul and losses that can never be replaced. Yes, there are injustices that beg for retribution, perhaps even punishment. But the deeper the pain and the more heinous the evil inflicted, the more obvious it is that nothing can be done to replace the loss. Forgiving is the only means of releasing the offender and freeing the spirit of the injured. How does this process begin? In the same way it did for the women who were victims of child abuse and the couples who lost a child, by first giving thanks. Some contend that the hardest part of giving thanks and forgiving occurs when new offenses continue to occur. Though they may have found strength to endure the big crisis, the onslaught of repeated injuries exhausts the soul. Whether it is a demeaning boss, a harsh spouse, a rebellious child, or losses due to illness, they struggle to rest in God's peace because the consequences must be borne every day. Giving thanks and forgiving must be a daily discipline in order to survive. One single mom I know explains it this way. "Forgiving my husband for the way he treated me during the divorce and custody process was just the beginning. For many years after, he verbally abused me and said things to try to turn the kids against me. When I thought things couldn't get worse, he married a mutual friend and moved nearby. Crazy it seemed at the time, I followed the counsel of friends and determined to ask God for the grace to forgive the both of us for the choices that had brought us to this point. Yes, this felt like a foolish thing to do. But as I gave thanks, God let me see his love in rescuing me from a highly destructive situation. Though I had prayed for our marriage to be healed, when all doors closed, I began to see that God would bring his good in a different way, and he did. More blessings than I can count. The best part may have been watching my kids get a head start in seeing how God's forgiveness is worked out in real time. As we walked it through together, we became bonded in God's love, and we learned that forgiving is an ongoing process, something that is utterly impossible to do apart from God's grace." This single mother's ability to give thanks in the midst of ongoing pain allowed her to lead her children to rest in God's father love. She told me, "Without God's grace, we never could have begun to forgive. But without giving thanks, even while in the midst of the mess, we would not have felt his grace. Giving thanks was the turning point to a new life for me and my children." A thankful heart stays at the foot of the cross, aware of its own need for forgiveness and the need to forgive others. Just as we can never right our wrongdoings to please God, some wrongs done to us or by us cannot be righted, repaid, or replaced. The debt is too large. As this young single mother learned, giving thanks releases the debt and opens the heart to a new life. It lets you enjoy what you already have, gives you hope that God is working through the unseen good, and reminds us that there are ways you are being protected that you don't catch. So I wonder, if thanksgiving is so powerful, why isn't it our first instinct? Why don't we do it before we can see a good reason for giving thanks? Do only fools thank God ahead of time? Kel Rickner, the pastor of Northwoods Church in Peoria, Illinois, shared with me a great story about how he learned to give thanks. He said, "I remember a situation from 1979. I was home for Christmas from college, and one afternoon, when just my mom and dad and I were home for lunch, as I approached the table, I saw my dad with his head down in his arms. That was very unlike him. And I said, 'Dad, what's the matter?' He said, 'I've got a $300 fuel bill that I don't know how I'm going to pay.' Everything inside of me wanted to say, 'Dad, let's pray about it. Turn it over to God and see what he does about it.' But I didn't say that. I didn't want to sound super spiritual. I didn't want to get my hopes up that God might do something and then see nothing happen. That's the real tension in faith. If you truly believe God for everything, there are going to be times that you'll feel like an idiot for trusting him because until he comes through, you don't know if he's going to. If he doesn't, then you feel like maybe You weren't supposed to trust his promise like that. So we play it safe and worry and fret instead of trust. What Cal decided to do in the situation was pray. He says, I went up to my bedroom after lunch because I was feeling bad for my dad, and I got down on my knees and prayed for him. Lord, Dad just never has anything to spare with all of us kids. It's always been so hard for him. Please bless him and provide for this fuel bill somehow. I will never forget his coming up the walk that day at 5 p.m. with a surprise Christmas bonus that the boss had given to all the employees that day. Care to guess the amount of the bonus? $300. What a great answer to prayer. But I remember praying, Lord, I want to learn how to cultivate a heart of faith and joy at noon before I actually see you solve the problem at 5. The circumstances said at noon. You're in a heap of trouble. You're not going to be able to pay your bills. You've got a reason to feel hopeless and dejected. And from our natural surroundings, we did. But those were the lies that were designed to take my eyes off my source. I was not any less secure at noon than at 5 p.m. Because of this, I want to trust God and give thanks to God ahead of time. I want to learn to pray, thank you, Lord. Though this fuel bill is due, and I don't know how I'm going to pay it, you are the source. Cal then shared that he is still learning to activate his faith through thanksgiving. For me, he said, the secret to operating in faith is found in this little word, thanksgiving. God responds to our sacrifice of thanksgiving. Years later, as the senior pastor of Northwoods Church, Cal and his church board had the opportunity to purchase extra land for their exploding church. The price, $300,000. Well, they didn't have $300,000, so they discussed borrowing and other options. Having learned over the years that thanksgiving releases his faith, Cal offered to God a sacrifice of thanksgiving. Knowing that he only wanted what God desired for the church, he did not worry. His thanksgiving lifted his burdens and brought peace and confidence. The next day, a businessman in the church sent Cal a check for $300,000. This man had no idea about the need or the board discussions. He simply felt led by God to give the church a check for $300,000. Cal doesn't receive miraculous interventions like this every time he prays, but these experiences have taught him that giving thanks allows him to remain calm and anticipate God's goodness regardless of the outcome. What is your need right now? Are you thanking God ahead of time? Are you learning to relax and release your faith through the giving of thanks? Sadly, many of us never learn this. When the $300 bill comes at noon, we pound the kitchen table in anger or kick the wall. Like Job's wife, we want to curse God and die. The miracle at 5 p.m. never comes because we've released ourselves to anger, not praise. And the Bible says in Proverbs 19:3, the foolishness of man ruins his way, and his heart rages against the Lord. Friend, don't ruin your way in this adventure of experiencing the unique will of God. Don't clench your fist in frustration. Open your hands to heaven and give thanks. Yes, it is a sacrifice of praise, but God receives your offering. Hebrews 13, verse 15 suggests, through him then, let us continually offer up a sacrifice of praise, that is, the fruit of lips that gives thanks to his name. If we reject this instruction, our hearts will be too hard to hear him speak his unique leading for us. His silence won't be because he wants to keep us at a distance, but because we have closed our hearts to him. If, however, we give thanks for the good and the unseen good in our difficult times, God will reveal his unique plan for us. Chapter 7. God's Will. Submit in doing right. Will we submit in doing right when no one watches? I have a married friend who told me that his wife lost a $2,800 diamond. Fortunately, his insurance policy covered lost jewelry. When he reported the lost diamond to his agent, he was informed that the company would immediately cut a check for $2,800. The only caveat was if the lost item was later found, they required that the owner either return the money or hand in the lost item. My friend understood the terms. He and his wife took the money and purchased a new diamond. As it would happen, a couple years later, they found the lost diamond down the crevice of a suitcase. My friend's immediate thought was, no one needs to know, and now we have a diamond we could sell for $2,800. However, his next thought came from the Lord. You need to submit in doing what is right. My friend knew 1 Peter 4:19, where Peter tells the believers to, quote, entrust their souls to a faithful Creator in doing what is right, end quote. Would he trust God and submit in doing what was right, though he would kiss goodbye the extra $2,800? Or would he sell the diamond and pocket the extra money? He called the insurance agent to report that they had found the lost diamond and would be returning the prize jewel to headquarters. He told me that as he hung up, an extraordinary peace and freedom flooded his soul. He knew he had done the right thing in submitting to the insurance company's terms. He had a clear conscience, and God was pleased. How many of us would do the opposite of my friend? We reason, hey, submitting and doing what is right will prevent me from gaining an extra $2,800, whereas doing what is wrong, when no one will know the difference, will put a nice chunk of change in my pocket that could be very useful. I ask this because when the insurance company's headquarters received the $2,800 diamond in the mail, an administrator reported back to my friend's insurance agent, we have never had a person send headquarters an item that was lost but then found. We don't know what to do with the diamond. Should we keep it or sell it? We have no policy in place since this has never happened. Even though their contract explicitly tells the insured to do this, no one ever did until my friend. I mean, this is just extraordinary to me. One would think more would send in the lost item since doing so would relieve the guilty feelings we are certain to have for submitting and doing what is wrong. Ill-gotten gains, according to Proverbs 10:2, rob a person of sleep and cause one to look over the shoulder. Fear of exposure is enslaving, whereas doing what is right enables one to sleep like a baby. The subconscious never forgets, and neither does the Lord. The believer gets away with nothing. Both suffering the loving discipline of God as well as forfeiting the unique leading and favor of God. At a deeper level, my friend perceived this was a test of his faith and obedience toward God's will. This wasn't an issue about stewardship or shrewdness, but about who he would be before God, no matter what. I can tell you this about my friend. Few are encountering the hand of God in their lives like he is. God's favor is all over this gentleman. There is a correlation between the hand of God being upon us and us keeping our hand out of the till. What is submission? This universal will of God on submission is located in 1 Peter, the second chapter, verses 13 through 15. It says, submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. For such is the will of God, that by doing right you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. When Peter wrote in verse 15, for such is the will of God, he is referring to what he just said before that about submitting to authority. Or was this a prelude to what he said immediately after about doing right to silence foolish men? Well, actually both. First, it related to submission to authority because of the larger context. Peter addresses submission with several groups. We are to submit as citizens, the second chapter, verse 13, as slaves, second chapter, verse 18, as wives, the third chapter, verse 1, as husbands in the same way, chapter 3, verse 7, and as the younger. You go on to chapter 5, verse 5. Submission literally means to place under or rank under. We submit by placing ourselves under or ranking under another's authority. Such submission is a choice we make. We are the ones who choose to obey the command. In 1 Peter, the second chapter, verses 17 and 18, and then in chapter 3, verse 3, and in chapter 3, verse 7, Peter instructs everyone, particularly slaves, wives, and husbands, to put on honor and respect when submitting and doing what is right. Submission includes both actions of deference and attitudes of deference. When a person submits an action but shows contempt and attitude, that individual misses the spirit of Peter's instruction. Paul teaches the same and especially states we are not to be, quote, disrespectful, end quote. 1 Timothy 6, verse 2. Why does God command us to respectfully submit then? Because we don't have a natural craving to do this on our own. If we did, the command would be moot. It is not natural to be respectfully submissive when required to do what we do not want to do. We prefer not to defer when it demands sacrifice. Something in us wants to be unsubmissive and disrespectful when told to do what we don't want to do. The fact is, most submission entails doing what is legally required according to the rules and regulations of the institution, and those policies are not evil per se, they're just demanding. We do not submit to an authority who demands that we do what is wrong. Second, this is why Peter stresses doing right in 1 Peter 2, verse 15, which is the other dimension of submission. We submit in doing right regardless of an authority figure standing over us. What does it mean, doing right? The Apostle Paul may help us understand what the apostles meant. We read Paul's instruction in Titus, the 3rd chapter, verses 1 and 2, quote, "Remind them to be subject to rulers, to authorities, to be obedient, to be ready for every good deed, to malign no one, to be peaceable, gentle, showing every consideration for all men," end quote. The way that gets worked out is we are to be those who are obeying the rules, ready to do good deeds, maligning no one, peaceable, gentle, and considerate. If we are these things, we are submitting to doing what is right in the eyes of God. Authority figures themselves must submit in doing right when no one oversees them. This is the reason the Bible tells them to recognize that they too have a master, referring to Jesus. We read that in Ephesians 6, verse 9, and Colossians 4, verse 1. Ultimately, all of us do this for the Lord's sake, which is what Peter was saying, for the Lord's sake. On a practical note, some of us live independently enough that we're not under the watchful eye of a supervising authority figure, according to Luke 12, verse 45. Our focus then needs to be on submitting and doing what is right for the Lord's sake when we have freedom to do what is wrong and can get away with it before other people. Why else submit in doing what is right when no one is looking? If we have critics, and most Christ followers do, those critics will look for us to do something wrong or notice it when we do. For this reason, when we keep submitting and doing right, we silence the foolish critics insofar as having hard facts against us. They cannot slander us for doing wrong since we did nothing wrong. Yes, there will be people criticizing us for doing right. People thought my friend an idiot for turning in the $2,800 diamond. There might be mockery, but there can be no incrimination. The mockery and criticism will quickly die without substance. When, though, we submit in doing wrong, and we have critics who find out, they will use this against us to our humiliation and punishment. No one will come alongside of us and praise us. According to 1 Peter, the 2nd chapter, verses 13 through 15, such submission prevents punishment for wrongdoing and garners praise for doing right, silences the false and foolish critics of our faith and values, and in effect wins the approval and protection of those over us. As odd as it sounds, when we submit in the way Peter addresses, we exercise spiritual authority over the hearts of those over us. Submission leads to influence. There is power in submission. However, this happens over time and may not happen at all. The issue is following God's will in submitting and doing what is right regardless of the outcome, but always with the vision that God will favor us, which is what Peter talks about in 1 Peter 2, verses 19 and 20. So then, there are two dimensions to submission. One, submit to what an authority figure rightfully requires of us. Two, submit in doing what is right independent of an authority figure because it is the right thing to do. For this book's purposes, let's combine these two dimensions to define submission as the following: respectfully doing what is rightfully required by an authority figure, even when we don't want to do it. and doing what is right apart from an authority figure because of our reverence for Christ. Is submission merely an inconvenience? Trust me, I've well heard the hesitation and concerns that may be coming to your mind. Emerson, you need to be cautious on this topic of submission. There are bad authority figures out there, and people could misread what you are writing here and go along with bad leadership. We must question authority. Besides, too many authorities are ripping us off, and we need to even the score where we can. The mere mention of the word submission ignites fear and anger in some folks, and probably from an excruciating encounter with an abusive authority figure. And I empathize with their knee-jerk reaction. But we must not indict every authority on the basis of a few bad apples. But this alarm is why not a few say to me, of the four wills, the one on submission really troubles me, and it is the one I struggle with the most. Unfortunately, fearing the worst side of submission, they inadvertently subvert the teaching on submission. In ringing the bell about the dangers or stupidity of submission, they ignore the safety and wisdom of such submission, not to mention contravene the Word of God. So let's get on the same page. We should never submit to authority figures who require us to lie, steal, or cheat. Nor should we submit to those who tell us to renounce our faith in Jesus Christ. God never intends this. But for most of us, that's not our predicament. We're not living inside a totalitarian regime that mandates by absolute decree that we reject Jesus Christ. In our daily life, no one compels us to be unprincipled and thereby compromise our morality or faith. Instead, we are addressing when an authority figure requests that we do something that is an inconvenience, not iniquitous. The authority's request may annoy us, but doing what they expect hardly turns us into an apostate. We may have to make changes, but none that make us criminal. For instance, management changes the beginning of the work shift from 9 a.m. to 6 a.m. There's nothing immoral, illegal, or unethical in this decision. Asking their employees to come to work at 6 a.m. may not be the best of decisions by management, but it is not a wicked requirement that demands we submit to evil and sin. Yet one would think, with some folks being asked of this, that an evil edict had been delivered and that mutiny, not submission, is God's will. But we all know that coming to work 3 hours earlier is hardly submission to a heretical lifestyle or grounds for a rebellious coup. The type of thing that should lead to insurrection is if you were a German citizen in the year 1939 and were commanded to submit to German Nazis who demand that you turn Jews over to be executed. We must not submit to that. It may be legal, but it isn't moral. Submission here would be qualitatively wrong and wicked. Gray areas versus black and white issues. For this reason, we must always distinguish between comparative issues and qualitative issues. By that I mean 9 a.m. compared to 6 a.m. may be a better time to start the workday. Who doesn't want to sleep in? But that is a comparison that can only allow us to argue that one decision is better than the other, not that one is intrinsically evil and the other is intrinsically good. To argue that management has made an evil decision with the 6 a.m. start time is to make a qualitative judgment, and this is more wrong as a judgment against management than management's decision to order us to be at work at 6 a.m. We'd be arguing that qualitatively 6 a.m. is an ungodly time and thus unbiblical to start work, whereas 9 a.m. is the time God intended people to start work. Of course, that's laughable, as it is untrue. Management's mandate to start at 6 a.m. is not vile. This is not a black and white issue. Therefore, if we have a rebellious attitude toward 6 a.m., we're not following the will of God. We are not submitting to authority for the Lord's sake in doing what is right according to management. And yes, it is right according to what management says is right. This is a gray area that allows for a great deal of legitimate differences of opinion, none of which are wrong, only different. In gray areas, management has the right to make the rules on what is right for the organization. As long as it isn't illegal, immoral, or unethical, we need to yield to the rule. Just because something doesn't feel right to us doesn't make it morally wrong. Our feelings are often due to being irritated by inconvenience, not due to our faith and conscience being compromised. We want to do what we want to do, and we want to do it, And we do not want to do what our authorities want us to do, and we don't want to do it. But Emerson, what if the inconvenience is too much for us, since we have to care for an elderly grandmother from 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m., feeding and dressing her? If we have the freedom to quit this job and work for another company, so be it. Grandma overrides our present employment. We are not defiant for resigning. This is a gray area. We are free to come out from under the company's authority structure based on our priorities and conscience. On the other hand, as long as we work under this company's authoritative hierarchy, God calls us to submit to 6 a.m. and to submit without a defiant attitude. As for our grandmother, we will need to figure out a way for someone to care for her from 7 to 8:30 a.m. This is our responsibility, not management's. When making an appeal, be appealing. Can we respectfully appeal to management to keep the starting time at 9 a.m.? Most organizations have lines of authority through which appeals can be made, and if so, the answer is absolutely yes. Or one might ask for an exception in order to take care of grandmother. Companies can be accommodating, and even co-workers can support us coming in at 9 a.m. while they come in at 6 a.m. if they know of our grandmother. Most management and co-workers are not without grace. But during the appeal process, we must say, I intend to come to work at 6 a.m. and to do my job, as I have always done. I will follow your decision. However, I wanted to express my concern and preferences. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to communicate with you. Most leaders respond positively to people who communicate their opinion with a submissive and respectful demeanor. Too often, conflicts arise between employees and management because the employee displays a rebellious attitude, and it is to this attitude management reacts. Management isn't reacting to the substance of the concern, but to the employee who launches right in with, I plan on quitting this job if you have us start at 6 a.m. I'm sick and tired of management's bad decisions. The employee's contempt and threats become the culprits, not the list of grievances that could have been communicated respectfully and submissively. When we make an appeal, we need to make sure they are saying no to the substance of our petition, and not because they are so offended they won't give us the time of day. The test of our submission comes when the authorities deny our request to keep the time at 9 a.m. Will we follow what Peter tells us, submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution? Will we show deference, knowing we are following God's will and putting ourselves in a favorable position for God to honor our obedience to Him? Remember, following the universal will of God activates the unique will of God. Though we may not get our way with management, we will know that we have obeyed our master. Giving the authority the benefit of the doubt. Though earlier in our lives, some of us were horribly treated by a parent, teacher, coach, man, uncle, boss, or pastor, we must not indict the whole based on the particular. Though this negative experience has put a bad taste in our mouths toward authority, we must not let ourselves view all authority as guilty until proven innocent. As tough as it is, we need to return to the wisdom of the courts. People are assumed innocent until proven guilty. Unless there are facts to prove guilt, we must not allow our past mistreatment to cause us to project onto all future authority figures the label of abuser. It is not appropriate to have a defiant spirit toward authority figures as a way of protecting ourselves from being hurt again. Maybe we were too naive earlier as we blindly trusted. But we do not become wise by impugning a leader's motives and showing contempt when there are no facts that prove the leader is corrupted. When we justify our rebelliousness as self-protective, we end up making enemies of people who are not our enemies. They may bother and annoy us with their requirements, but they are not out to abuse us. Are you making the wrong people your enemy? Are you being asked by decent people, albeit imperfect, to respectfully do what is rightfully required of you, but you have a chip on your shoulder? Will God unfold His unique will for you if you have clenched fists ready to strike first? Bad authority or bad submitter? Consider the story of two sons in their 20s living at home. Though the son's parents had established the rule of no drinking or smoking at home, one day the mom arrived home to find her two sons along with some friends puffing away in the backyard. Shocked, she reminded the sons of the family rule. Claiming they were adults, they told their mom that they could smoke if they wanted to smoke. When things escalated into a heated fight, the mom, in utter frustration, smashed some dishes. The sons responded by calling the police. When the officers found out the facts, one officer zeroed in on the son, saying, "Let me get the facts straight. You were living on your parents' property, not working, paying no rent, and eating free food. Furthermore, you have one basic rule. Don't smoke or drink on the premise. Because you don't like that rule, you called the police on your own mother. Yes, she smashed dishes, but that's not why you called, is it? You called the police to punish your mother for her rule. What kind of men are you? Get a life. Move out if you don't like the rule." Some of us need to hear this will on submission precisely because we fool ourselves like these two sons into thinking that those over us take advantage of us. They are unfair. When often we control the situation through our resistance and coercion, we claim victimhood, but harbor an attitude of entitlement and make controlling demands. Though we perceive ourselves as submitting to the boss, parent, government, spouse, teacher, or board, we display a disposition of disgust. Or we utter threats such as, "I will sue you," or "I'm running away," or "I refuse to pay taxes," or "I won't be treated like a doormat," or "I won't do the assignment," or "I won't follow the board's policy." We claim the authority is bad when we are just a bad submitter. I recently heard of one Christian couple who refused to pay taxes for 13 years despite the clear counsel of Romans 13, verse 1 and verse 6 and 7. As native Hawaiians, they felt their heritage entitled them to a God-given exemption. They rationalized their position by convincing themselves that the authorities had no right to enact this tax. Another man illegally copied DVDs from a ministry. When a group member queried, "Hey, did you get permission to copy these?" he retorted, "No way. They shouldn't sell the Word of God." He believed he had a right to disregard copyright laws because he felt ministries should not charge. Of course, it didn't enter his mind to donate to those ministries. Some refused to submit to the loving counsel of church elders. The leadership at one church gently confronted a husband for yelling at his wife in the church parking lot, Hebrews 13, 17. After this truthful rebuke, the husband left the church. He claimed he intended to obey God, not man, which warped the meaning of Acts 5, verse 29. Such stories seem endless. Will such people experience the unique will of God? Unlikely. Their pet peeves and attitudes, sabotage, all that God intended to do on their behalf. Are we demanding and coercive? What can we learn from the two brothers who tried to coerce their mother and the police, the couple in Hawaii who willfully ignored the law to pay taxes, the man who defied copyright laws, or the husband who rejected the church leadership as having no right to confront him? These people see themselves as right and righteous. However, they have become self-righteous and self-deceived. They are neither teachable nor submissive. They do not see themselves as the problem. Those making the rules, in their opinion, are to blame. The brothers hung on to their poor me attitude, believing that they were the victims, not their mother. The couple in Hawaii clung to their belief that they had a legal entitlement to refuse paying taxes. The guy who copied copyrighted material dug his heels in, since in his dogmatic opinion, he represented God's view. The husband who left the church after the elders confronted him saw himself biblically justified to confront and reject the leadership. The human heart does not naturally submit nor show respect to those God calls to be authorities over us. The heart is naturally defiant when inconvenienced or not getting what it wants. Sadly, some of us don't see this part of our lives. What makes this hard to discern about ourselves is when we see ourselves as so caring and conscientious that we blind ourselves to our controlling and contemptuous methods. Do you recall the story of Martha and Jesus? She complained to Jesus that Mary, her sister, neglected to help her with the preparations to serve the guests. Instead, Mary sat at the feet of Jesus listening to him. Martha boiled. She bristled as she made preparation for the meal. Then, fed up, Martha engaged the perfect, loving, and caring Son of God and asked a stunning question. Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to do all the serving alone? She then barked a command to the command giver. Then tell her to help me. The story goes down in Luke 10, verse 40. Can you imagine this? Martha looked into the eyes of love and told love itself that he does not care. In effect, she felt that she cared more than the Son of God cares. She then ordered the Lord of Lords to do what she requested. She took control by telling God what to do. You know, I have a hunch that Martha requested that the Apostle John include this story about her to give testimony to how we can fail to see ourselves at various moments when we feel unfairly treated. We can turn controlling and irreverent and not see it. Learn it early or learn it late. Recently, I counseled a man in his 40s who was employed in a huge family-owned company. As a result of the company's success, this man possessed everything the world offers. But more than anything, he desired God to use him. However, as an adult son working for his father, he struggled with submitting to his dad, who exercised final authority in the company. I told him that unless he responded correctly to his father, I didn't believe God would bless him or use him in the way that he hoped. Though he agreed with the principle, he struggled to obey it. He knew that if he did not deal with God's instruction, the Lord would not fully bless him with a clear conscience, his divine presence and effectiveness in prayer and a fruitfulness in ministry. Because he still harbored adolescent attitudes of disrespect when he felt criticized by his father, he almost tendered his resignation and walked away from the opportunity of his life. At 40, this man still struggled to demonstrate a submissive attitude, something he should have learned as a teen. There are no exceptions. Learn it early or learn it late. Again, one can be respectful and submissive in demeanor and accomplish the same thing that one feels can only be accomplished via a disrespectful and non-submissive demeanor. Knowledge and wisdom carry their own weight. This 40-year-old son didn't need to clench his fists and growl while making his substantive points to his dad. Granted, not every authority makes request of us that we deem to be wise and necessary. Peter makes this point absolutely clear in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 18. Some authority figures make unreasonable demands on us because they are not good nor gentle people, which is what he says specifically in that text. But if it isn't immoral, is the Lord using this to prepare us for his unique mission? I think of Jesus at age 12 who stunned the religious leaders as he taught them in the temple in Jerusalem. But it was not time for his ministry to begin. And when his parents found him there, they required of him to return home. But note what the Apostle Luke records, quote, "And he went down with them and came to Nazareth, and he continued in subjection to them. And Jesus kept increasing in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and men." Luke, the second chapter, verses 51 and 52. When you submit in doing right, it can lead to an increase in wisdom, stature, and favor with God and people. There is an upside to submission. Take heart when the deference is not your preference. In time, there can be incredible dividends. My pastor, Jeff Mannion, shared his experience of submission that was a turning point in his encounter with God. He told me, "I was 17, the summer between my junior and senior year in high school. I was an avid runner and training for the Sacramento Marathon. I know a race may not seem like a big deal, but as a 17-year-old, this was huge to me, and my training was well underway. Because I was working in the state of Wyoming for the summer, I needed my father to get me registered there in Sacramento where the family resided. During our next phone conversation, my father told me that he discovered that the marathon was on a Sunday and that he didn't want me running a race on the Lord's Day. This made a lot of sense to him and no sense to me. However, I did something highly uncharacteristic. I said, okay. Without a fight and without drama, I simply said, okay. Somehow in that moment, I was conscious of the fact that the Lord had placed my dad as an authority figure in my life, and that to respond respectfully to my dad's authority was not simply to submit to him, but to submit to the authority of Christ in my life. Something hit me deeply in my heart that I couldn't respect Christ while disrespecting my dad. In retrospect, I believe this was a huge breakthrough in my faith journey. It was not only about obeying my dad, but more to do with submitting to Christ's authority. My walk with Jesus rocketed forward at this point. As Jeff reflects today, he knows that if he had argued belligerently about his right to run on Sunday and been defiant, he would have forfeited a major breakthrough in his relationship with the Lord. However, because he obeyed the universal will of God on submission, he activated his experience of the unique will of God, which he sees clearly now as an adult. Something changed between Christ and him. Jeff demonstrated to God that he would submit to his authority and unique leading because he submitted to his dad's authority and unique leading. There is a correlation. Have we learned to submit? Most of us are under authority by our choice, and we know that we could come out from underneath the authority if we choose. So, what do we do when the authority tells us not to do something, and we see it as a good thing for us to do? Should we leave the authority structure or stay? I assume that in most cases the authority figure does not have evil will nor requests us to do evil. Most authority figures try to do what is best for the organization. The boss may be misguided here and there, but the boss does not have ill will. Even so, we strongly differ with the requirements, so should we leave or stay? If we are the compliant type who never steps out in faith, maybe this is the time to change jobs and launch out on something that is new and more compatible with our interests. If we are the defiant type who will eventually lead others, waiting longer could be the advisable route given one has not learned well how to submit. Whoever we are, have we learned submission in that we know how to consistently and respectfully do what is required of us? If not, it may not be time to exit. God has great plans for us, but if we have not learned to be submissive, then it isn't time to push eject on the job. B.J. Weber, the former chaplain of the Yankees and my good friend since the 1970s, talked to me about his days of rebellion in Dubuque, Iowa. As the town rowdy in his late teens and early 20s, he ignited trouble in most of the places he frequented. For example, one evening he set the record in the city for the most tickets, an embarrassing number of violations according to BJ. He lived a reckless life to cover up his empty soul. He yearned for meaning, but could find no significance. Referring to himself as a rebel in search of a cause, he joined SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, and actively participated in the anti-war and hippie movement of the 1960s. Nothing, however, could answer the deep questions in his heart. Living in Dubuque, a heavily Catholic community with Trappistine nuns and Trappist monks, B.J. visited New Mallory Abbey to purchase the monk's bread. As B.J. walked out of the monastery with a loaf of bread, a monk at the foot of the stairs, Father Matthias, initiated a conversation with B.J. "Hey, you look interesting. What are you all about?" B.J. wanted bread that he purchased for his mother, not a conversation. But he said, "What do you care?" However, the humble, loving Father Matthias didn't let it go. As the conversation continued, Father Matthias invited BJ to have a cup of coffee. He recognized that BJ's hunger for homemade bread paled in comparison to his hunger for the bread of life. As the dialogue deepened, the men discussed the purpose of life, and BJ turned the conversation and asked derisively, "So, what are you all about?" Father Matthias replied, "I'm about Jesus Christ, and I'm here to pray for people in the burdens, and I know you are carrying a lot of burdens." This led to a conversation about how to get faith. Eventually, Father Matthias told BJ, "The first step is to invite Christ into one's life." Right then, it was as though someone lit a match in BJ's dark soul. Frightened and exposed, he stayed in the light to feel its warmth and newfound friendship. Could Jesus be the light of the world, he wondered. Could Jesus be the bread of life? B.J. invited Christ into his heart, and something good happened. This began a holy cleansing for B.J. His shame and defilement from darkness and evil behavior lifted. B.J. took his first step to become a Christ follower. Living with a gal, he told her what happened. He was so excited, saying, "Something happened with Jesus and God and me and this monk, and he wants me to come back and study the Bible." Upon hearing that, she moved out the next day. Sometime later, B.J. moved onto the farm to serve the monks and nuns. Mother Columba, head of the convent, took special interest in this young man, who a year later entered a Presbyterian seminary in Dubuque. Like a mother, she counseled him almost on a daily basis in the things of Christ. So when Sherwood Wirt of Billy Graham's Decision Magazine heard B.J.'s testimony and invited him to share it at a Billy Graham crusade in Cincinnati, Ohio, B.J. hurried to the convent to inform Mother Columba of this incredible invitation to share Christ with thousands. "What do you think, Mother?" "B.J., you are entirely too young in your faith. This would ruin you. I don't think you should do this." Shocked, B.J. naively replied, "Well, I'm going to do this." "If you do this, we will always love you, but you can only visit on weekends. You cannot stay here." B.J. was stunned and puzzled as to why she would not sanction him responding to the opportunity to share the love of Christ with thousands. He could not believe what his ears were hearing. Frustration and hurt pulsed through his body. After a few moments, he asked, "Then what do you want me to do?" She said sternly, "I want you to clean the sheep barn." At that moment, B.J. had to make a decision. Would he submit to her spiritual wisdom and authority, or pursue what he considered the opportunity of a lifetime? With his head down and his shoulders sloped, he got up and walked to the sheep barn. For the next 6 hours, by himself, he did nothing but clean. But God was also cleansing. While B.J. worked on the stalls, God worked on his soul. B.J. recounts this episode. Strangely, after a couple hours of battling, an unexplained joy descended on my soul. I knew that I needed to learn to submit. I knew I needed to follow the counsel. In that sheep's barn, the shepherd met me. He sheared the wool from my eyes, and I am eternally grateful. I look back over 3 decades and sing his praises for my decision to submit. My heart mattered to my Lord far and above my ministry for my Lord. If I had not learned to submit, as you say, respectfully doing what was rightfully required of me, when I did not want to do it, I do not believe my ministry in New York on the streets with the poor and the prostitutes, and then on to Wall Street with the prosperous and the professionals, or with athletes, would have lasted. Choosing to submit to Jesus in the face of temptations and trials and willfulness, I was learning obedience, mucking sheep's manure off a smelly stall floor, doing what I was supposed to do, not what I wanted to do. That moment of obedience and submission opened unique doors far greater than Billy Graham's Cincinnati Crusade, as significant as that event proved to be for others. Rebels need to hear BJ's testimony, especially those who are ambitious, highly concerned about status, and disgruntled by delays. While eventually many of these rebels rise to leadership positions, God often tames them through the discipline of submission so that they do not mess up future opportunities. Scripture warns that when you make wrong choices early on, refusing to submit to God's ways, then you, quote, groan at your final end, end quote, Proverbs 5:11. It is a simple principle of leadership. If I haven't learned to submit to authority as a follower, when I am a leader, I will abuse my authority, and God knows this. But what if the person over us in authority does not have our best interest at heart, or so we feel this way? What about frustrations with unreasonable authority? In 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 13 through 16, Peter focuses our attention on what God does when we face unfair treatment. Indeed, some of us suffer because an authority figure treats us harshly for no good reason. Though they do not demand that we do evil, they make our life miserable because of who they are. The good news is that God is pleased with you when you do what you know is right and patiently endure unfair treatment.